Welcome to the Detroit Football Network podcast. I'm Justin Rogers, joined by Will Birchfield. And Will, I got to tell you, I miss the week one intro. Unfortunately, we violated every copyright law known to man and got that axed. But hopefully we'll get something cool again someday.
You know what I miss? I miss when the Lions played on Sunday at 1 o'clock and we could be home by Sunday at 9 o'clock. These primetime games, because they have been so good for the past year and a half, are starting to catch up to me. I find myself needing this bye week as much as maybe the players.
I saw you leaving Ford Field as I was walking to go start a podcast with Stoney. And so that tells you how my night went. I think I got to bed around 5, and you know what? What a terrible week to have a bye week, right? Like, I feel like Monday was gone, Tuesday was gone, and so really today was the start of the bye week, and all I did was spend it watching film. So I got so much on my plate. I'm not getting any time off. I hope you're getting a little time off.
Yeah, not really. The Tigers have basically taken hostage my bye week. So whatever time I was going to have off is now devoted to covering the most ridiculous, improbable, maybe even impossible playoff run of all time.
I kind of was glad I got to watch a game today. I've not watched much Tiger baseball this year. I feel like the Andy Ibañez down 0-2 to Hader and coming through with a base clearing double was, I think, it epitomized everything, right?
Right off the bench, too. I mean, cold-blooded.
Unbelievable. So, yeah, this is now the Detroit Baseball Network podcast, which, by the way, I looked if that was available. It is not. So the network is not expanding anytime soon. Look, so we're in a bye week here. The game has kind of been processed from Monday night. I've got two cats that are fighting behind me for the open window space. Perfect. You never know what you're going to get in a live podcast or recorded podcast. But it's kind of doesn't really work out with the math on a 17-game schedule, but it is kind of the quarter point of the season. And look, it's a crappy time, I think, for a bye, but also maybe not the worst time for these Lions with some of the injuries they've had. But I think we should kind of just take a temperature today on where this thing is at offensively and defensively, you know, where you think the team is at. And then we'll throw out a little mailbag call to the kids over at the Detroit Football Network. And so we'll without doing any prep work, we'll just go through their questions live and see where that gets us.
I love it. I think through four games, we've yet to see this team play a complete game, and they're still pretty comfortably 3-1. I mean, it was the offense last week on a day that the defense gave up 500 yards and they won by two scores. It was the defense the week before on a day that the offense didn't score a point in the second half and they won by a touchdown. And it was basically 4 minutes of David Montgomery in week one against the Rams. As a unit, I think this team, by its own standard, has probably played B-minus football, and through four games, they've won three. I think that bodes really well for where they might be going as the season goes on. I mean, the defense has had A-plus performances. The offense had its first A-plus performance on Monday night, but they have yet to do that at the same time, and still here they are at 3-1. I think this team has to be feeling pretty good about itself through the first proverbial quarter of the season.
Yeah, and let's start with the offense, because, you know, before we got going here, the 10 minutes of prep work that I put into this thing, you know, I was looking over the roster and trying to find the area of the offense that I would label a concern. And it's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to figure it out. You look at the backfield. I think the Montgomery-Gibbs tandem is working just about how you would hope and expect. The offensive line, obviously, Ragnow's a little banged up. That's a concern, outside of the traditional performance level concerns. But the offensive line, I think, is playing pretty close to expectations. Tim Patrick is kind of filling that void. Jameson Williams is having the breakout we'd expect. Sam Laporta is looking like he's shaking the rust that lingered from the hamstring. And so I'm looking at it, I'm going, man, like the 42 points that they scored against the Seahawks is kind of what I expect from this team. They're just talented top to bottom. They've got a great play caller, and it was only a matter of time before they hit their stride.
Yeah, it's funny. We were having this conversation, I think, 2 weeks ago. Maybe it was after the Buccaneers loss on our Lions review show, which you guys can hear on 97.1 The Ticket on Monday nights.
Cross promotion.
Tuesday nights after a Monday night game, some more shameless self-promotion. And the topic was basically, what is a valid concern for this offense? And I think then I pointed to the Josh Reynolds vacancy and feeling like there wasn't anyone who was equipped to replace him. And man, 2 weeks later, I kind of feel like Tim Patrick is emerging. Now, that question mark still exists. I'm not ready to say that Tim Patrick has fully emerged as the next Josh Reynolds, but man, we're seeing Goff look his way more and more. I know you and I both talked to him in the locker room after the Monday night game, and he said, look, man, we're just getting started. He said, it really feels like once this team really needs me, and the stakes rise and the games mean more down the stretch. And I've had, by that point, 2 to 3 to maybe 4 months of practice time with Jared. He said, it's going to be beautiful. And it isn't beautiful yet, but you can see exactly why they brought him in. I mean, he is the exact profile physically they were seeking in that wide receiver 3 spot. And I look at this offense now and projecting it over the next 2 months, I don't feel like there is a legitimate worry. The only real one that will forever linger as long as the season goes on is just making sure those 5 guys up front stay healthy. But even without Frank, they had their best offensive game of the season. So it feels like searching for weaknesses is creating weaknesses that aren't even there sometimes for this offense.
Yeah, I thought Coyote, you know, really stepped in and played well at guard, and you break it down play by play, and you see, you know, some little inconsistencies, but like to get C level play, to get average replacement level player play from a backup offensive lineman in this league is the equivalent of getting a Pro Bowl starter. I mean, it's so hard to find those guys, and you know, I think they've really, you know, stumbled upon just, it feels like depth everywhere. You know, Brad Holmes has done such a nice job building depth. And there's probably still a level of concern at receiver. You know, what happens if a Jameson Williams or an Amon-Ra or, you know, even Tim Patrick suffers an injury, like where do they go from there? It's probably a little problematic, but you know, you probably just replace it with targets elsewhere, whether it's Laporta or Gibbs or Montgomery. And so, you know, it's just such a well-oiled machine. You know, they had some hiccups there the first 3 weeks, but I think that's just, I mean, I've covered this a long time and it feels like that's normal. You don't always come out the gate firing and probably usually don't come out the gate firing. And it's about building toward it. I feel like I'm quoting Matt Patricia right now and I apologize for it, but that's what football is, right? Like you're building.
Well, the Lions are enjoying the fruits of his labor. Haven't you heard?
I won't throw the media member under the bus, but there is one local media member that can't help himself watching that show every week. I have not tuned in. I'm sure it's actually excellent, but I've heard that they go out of their way to not talk about the Lions each week, which I find just perfectly petty and hilarious.
Yeah, very on brand.
Defensively, you know, just flipping gears to that side. Wait,
one more note on the
offense. Absolutely.
I have been really impressed with the rapport early on between Jared Goff and J-Mo. And I know it hasn't equated to a bunch of catches in that category, but the times he has looked J-Mo's way, it has looked different to me than it has over the past season and a half. And honestly, Justin, like even in training camp this year, I wasn't among those convinced that J-Mo was going to have this breakout season. And he probably still has some more work to do in that regard, though he is top 10 among receivers in yards and yards per catch. But I watched a player in training camp who was facing a lot of the same issues and pratfalls that he was for his first season and a half year, which was miscommunication with Jared Goff, an issue of drops that crept up later in camp, and just a route runner who didn't seem fully polished. And fast forward to the season and through 4 games anyways, I really haven't seen those hurdles. Like he looks more and more like a complete receiver. And this is why they drafted him, because he can touch the ball twice in a single game and still leave a huge imprint on the outcome of that game. I mean, he makes two catches on Monday night, but one of them goes for 70 yards on a play where he was high-stepping for the final 30 yards because he has that level of explosiveness. And I'm not putting my hand up in any way because we're only four games in, and J-Mo still has lots to do. But the way that he and Jared have established a more consistent connection has really caught my eye. And I don't know how you have viewed it, but I needed more convincing than what I saw in training camp, and I've received it through four games.
Yeah, I've kind of gone in waves with him, probably similar to the way he's played, right? Like I was really high on him, probably peaked, you know, middle of training camp, and it just seemed like everything was clicking, everything was heading in this direction. Then you mentioned it, it's the drops, they show up, and it felt like he didn't have one for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and then he had one, and then he had one the next day, then he had two the next day, and he had one the next day, and it's like, and I started wondering, you know, how much does he get in his own head with mistakes? You know, I think that's, you know, athletes, young athletes in particular, have, you know, those hiccups where they compound, and that's a veteran mentality to truly be able to put the mistakes behind you. And I wondered, you know, if that was something where he wasn't quite there in his development yet, and I was wondering if that was going to hinder him. And I think the way I've kind of described him is he's still prone to those really wild swings of production, and mm-hmm. in a way we've seen that this year, right? We've seen the 150 yard opener or whatever it was, and then we saw 9 yards against Arizona where they did everything they could to take him away. And I think you could see a little bit late in that game with his body language, there was some frustration as he was running vertical route after vertical route after vertical route. And, you know, Goff looked many, many times and even tried to force one in there late in the game, but it wasn't there. It was just what the defense was doing in Arizona to take him away. And I said this to Stoney in the post game. I was encouraged to see the way that 70-yard route developed because it was different than running him just a straight nine route, straight go route down the seam or from the, you know, the boundary or field alignments. He ran it deep over, and it was designed with Amon-Ra running the go route on the other side to clear it out for him, and it worked. And you look at film from any NFL team, and that deep over route is such a tough cover. You got a fast guy or a big guy, it becomes even tougher to cover. And so you know, you're gonna need to see Ben Johnson come up with more creative ways, and whether that's deep curls or over routes or shallow crosses, just things that find ways to get him the ball, get him in space, keep him mentally involved as much as physically involved is going to be really imperative. But I think I kind of set an expectation for him for 800 yards. He's currently on pace for 1200. I think that's awesome. He really is enjoying the true breakout. You know, I expected it to a degree, but I mean, he's obviously exceeding those, and you know, something the Lions really needed that rounds out what they do offensively.
Goff delivered that ball at a perfect time too, on that 70-yard touchdown,
because so early.
As soon as Jameson caught it, his defender was being picked by the Lions player inadvertently. I think it was Laporta running across, and it was just a perfectly timed ball. And when you hit him in stride, he's thinking touchdown every mm-hmm. single time. And
he should be.
More often than not, he's going to get there. I also think, you know, we've talked about Jameson in theory for basically 2 years, and now we're seeing it in practice. And Ben Johnson mentioned this for the first time last week, the Jameson effect, and it's real in what it forces defenses to do, because the first 2 weeks he has two pretty big games, including two, I believe, 50 plus yard catches, and the Cardinals and Seahawks both made a concerted effort to defend the deep part of the field with Jameson out there, which is basically every snap now on offense. And that focus on committing resources over the top and playing deeper safeties is part of the reason, just part of the reason, that the Lions have had their two best rushing games against the Cardinals and the Seahawks. So the speed, which we heard about for 2 years, is now actually bending defenses when he's on the field. And the snap counts really stand out to me. And this is now just the Jameson Williams podcast. I guess we're just going to go into JMO mode, but he's playing 80%, almost 90% of the offensive snaps now. This is a guy
who snapped Amon-Ra last game.
Who could barely play 50, 60% of the snaps even the end of last season. So the trust is there, the production is there, and now the effect is there. And man, maybe this is the dawn of a really great player and the next great Brad Holmes draft pick.
Yeah, and I think Ben Johnson kind of summed it up perfectly. I don't know if it was a week or two ago, and he said, you know, we're unique in that way that we have that explosive downfield weapon. And it's not just him, but he is the primary, right? But also the power running game. And mm-hmm. and that's a lot to stress out a defense. And so I'm going to add to this Jameson Williams
nice.
Podcast. you will appreciate this. I hope the audience will appreciate this. I've been asking guys for a story I'm working on that's not important, but fun, right? Their favorite Metro Detroit restaurant. And so I was, of course, very curious what Jameson would have, because he's just, you know, he's got different interests than most guys in that locker room. And he told me about It Smackin'. Will, are you familiar with It Smackin'?
No, I thought he was going to say the Mickey D's on Jefferson, where he got his Oreo McFlurry. Is what do you call it, the McFlurry double? McDonald's concoction was.
Tried that week. Yet?
But I know, no. I have not heard of It Smackin'.
I think it's kind of got a TikTok following because Keith Lee came down and tried it out. But there's two locations. There's one in Redford, and It Smackin' podcast. But and then they have a soul food location in the Southfield Lathrop Village area. And so I pitched it to the boys. Ben Raven from M Live and Colton Pouncey from The Athletic joined me.
Nice.
And we went to this soul food location today. And let me tell you, we got some lamb chops. We got some turkey ribs, which I didn't know was a thing. I mean, I knew turkeys had ribs. I just didn't know they served them. Yeah. Got some oxtail, some collards, some mac Damn. And cheese, some cornbread. Oh, very, very light lunch, you know, just
like, and you guys all went to the gym afterwards.
Yeah, no, I skipped breakfast and dinner today. Will, I'll tell you, I was hurting. That made it tough getting through the Tigers game. But look,
so I think the Detroit Football Network podcast brought to you by It's Smackin' has some real potential. We need to reach out to them to potentially sponsor this.
JMO didn't let me down. He came through with a recommendation. I like soul food. I don't have a great spot to go to. So certainly was a very interesting and fun bye week activity. And look, I can get down some oxtail.
So, yeah, man.
And look at this. I mean, we killed enough time on the offense, on JMO, on soul food, that Zach, our producer, is going to be thrilled because we got to the first commercial break and we haven't even touched the defense yet.
Good for us.
We'll take a little break here. We'll come back after some messages and we'll talk about the defense. All right, we're back on the Detroit Football Network podcast. And, you know, Will and I were talking about the offense kind of this quarter point season. We're going to flip it over to the defense, which, you know, played phenomenally through three games, but, you know, hit some hiccups here in on that Monday night game. I imagine that's going to happen when you play 90 snaps and you're trying to replace a few guys. But, you know, Will, what's your level of concern, area of concern with the defense going forward? You know, and maybe how much is that affected by recency bias of that last game?
Yeah, I think the concern is seeing the way the run defense was gouged on the outside, and knowing that had a lot to do, in my mind anyways, with Derek Barnes' absence. And he has been such a versatile piece for them. And he has played a pretty big role in setting the edge against the run. And also missing Brian Branch last week did not help the cause. I mean, he's one of their best tacklers. I thought that they struggled to tackle in the secondary, and this has been, for the most part, a pretty sound tackling team in the back end, but he'll be back after the bye. But I thought Barnes's absence was noticeable last week, and you have to hope that is a player who can return once he's eligible to come off IR. It sounds like they're going to give it some time to heal before determining if he needs surgery, which would be most likely an extension of his absence. But we have rarely seen this Lions defense gashed by the run, and they weren't on the interior. I mean, they were still as stout as ever up the middle, but Kenneth Walker, who sure seems to freestyle a lot behind the line and just kind of find the lanes that maybe aren't even there as the play is designed, he got them. And I thought it was clear that they were missing Derek Barnes for a lot of that game. But look, they have crowed a lot about their linebacker depth, and I think it's going to be put to the test in Barnes's absence. Ben Neiman was victimized on some of those plays, and they're going to have to find ways to replace Barnes, which isn't easy because he was doing so many things. I mean, he was playing in the nickel against Puka Nacua in week one, and he's been rushing the passer, and he's been playing the strong side linebacker. He's setting the edge against the run. He's doing so many things. So a long way of saying, I think we realized how important Derek Barnes was to the defense when he went down.
It's kind of wild how far he's come, right?
It's like, incredible. You know, yeah.
Last year, I think going into the season, nobody believed he would even have a role.
Including him, dude. He was like fretting his own place on the roster in training camp. He was beginning to doubt whether or not he was going to be here long term.
Yeah, he texted Calvin Shepard draft night after they took Campbell. And, you know, Shep reassured him as much as possible. And I think Shep's always been Barnes' biggest supporter, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, the effort he put in last offseason to learn the defense from a conceptual level and really learning all 11 spots on the field and how they work together, you know, really paid dividends for him last year, but even more so this year. I was talking, you know, quite a bit about his just subtle positioning and taking things away that were creating opportunities for guys that maybe weren't showing up on the stat sheet. But I just thought Barnes was off to a tremendous start. And, you know, I'm looking now at, you know, the snap chart from Monday night, and it's, you know, it's tough to say what was dictated by the personnel of the opponent and what was, you know, them trying to figure out, you know, a way to replace Barnes. But obviously, Amik Robertson played a much bigger role.
Yeah.
They played more nickel, which I think was a logical solution to Seattle's personnel.
Yeah, even though Aaron Glenn wanted nothing to do about talking about it last week, which is probably a pretty good sign that they indeed plan to play the nickel defense.
Yeah, that's right. Reading the tea leaves, right? And then you mentioned Neiman. Neiman played 23 snaps. Malcolm played 31. Campbell actually played less than I thought. He played 68% at 61 snaps. And then, you know, got Jalen Reese-Maben, James Houston, Trevor Nowoski got in for 8 snaps late. And
yeah,
6 of those were as an edge rusher, which, you know, probably speaks to how they were feeling about James Houston at that point in the game. But, like, it really was like an all-hands-on-deck, you know, approach to replacing Barnes. And honestly, I think they're it's going to be that way for a little bit. You know, I think they're going to try to figure out mixing and matching. I thought Neiman was a little bit of a disappointment. It's one game. I'm not going to, you know, throw the guy under the bus. He had a pretty good preseason. I think he's earned an extended opportunity, but it was very, very small. It was 8 snaps, but I want to see more of Trevor Nowoski. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I looked on PFF. He had 3 pressures on 6 edge rush snaps. So that's something.
Yep.
And then there was a play in my film review today, and I haven't got around to writing the defensive side of things. If I do, I'll do it tomorrow. But there was a broken play, and Nowoski was playing zone, and he matched with a Seattle receiver, and the other guy that had dropped into coverage was Levi, which shouldn't.
Yeah, I remember this play.
It was fine to start, but as the play broke down, like, that's just not a guy that knows what to do in a scramble drill. And Nowoski almost recovered enough to get to the where Geno went with the ball, and it was a really athletic play. He saw it. Everything about the way he kind of processed through the play, I said, okay, that was heads up. It was heads up all the way across the board. So if he's getting some pressures as a pass rusher and he's making those kind of heads up plays and coverage, like, look, 8 snaps is not a sample size. You can judge anything, but I would like to see a little bit more from him because I was impressed with what I did see.
Yeah. And on the flip side, James Houston got his biggest dose of snaps of the year. Probably ensured that he won't get that many snaps again, at least in the near future. I think the second time he went offsides, you and I, who sit side by side in the press box, you turned to me and basically said, that might be it for James Houston. And I'm not quoting you directly, but look, he's waited for his opportunity. They have told him when the opportunity comes, you need to produce. They have told him that basically through us, and I'm sure also directly. And that was not the game that James Houston needed to win himself more playing time when the second quarter of the season begins. And I just wonder about his future on this team now.
I think it's valid questions, and it's really unfortunate, but I keep saying it. What he does well, which is bend the edge. I mean, he's Gumby. He's Gumby with actually great. He plays with great hands. I mean, he really does. I've said this before, like just watching him run through pass rush drills that these guys do kind of after practice, like his hands are a blur. They just move so fast. But what that does is it creates opportunities for him to get the edge. Yep. And this is a pocket crushing team. And I'll tell you this, like Geno Smith played incredible in that game because there were so many times that they just crushed the can on him, as Glenn and Campbell like to say. Like I thought Pascal actually played a really good game. I was really encouraged by his performance. I think, you know, the way they're using Levi on the edge and inside, he continues to impress. He's been really, really good this year. I think they're going to be able to overcome Davenport maybe a little easier than they will Barnes because of that. But I just don't see how Houston fits in the mix. I think they're going to look elsewhere if he can't take advantage of these opportunities. And I don't know. Like I said, I don't know how many opportunities he's going to get after jumping offside twice in however many snaps it was, 14, 15, 16, wasn't many. And, you know, it's devastating.
Yeah, it's interesting comparing Houston and Pascal, because if you gave Houston, say, 50 defensive snaps in a game like Pascal got last weekend, yeah, he might produce a handful of pressures and he would probably get home for a sack, but he would also open you up on a number of those plays to gash plays, either the quarterback using his legs or the quarterback having too much time, because Houston has been basically just pushed out of the picture and he has receivers open downfield. I don't think the Lions are willing or even interested in, say, the handful of pressures and the sack that might come with them when they are negated by plays where Houston strays outside of their defensive principles. And I think what they like about Pascal so much is that he does play to their principles. And they know that while he might not have as many splash plays and he might not show up a ton in the box score at the end of the game, that he will do his job in the defense. He will fulfill his role as the edge setter, the big end opposite Hutchinson. And I don't think he has the same level of violence or even force as Davenport. I mean, Davenport can bull rush the hell out of you. Yeah. I mean, he'll basically headbutt through you, but they can trust that Pascal will do his job as it is defined. And if that doesn't equate to big statistical nights, they're okay with that, because it also won't create opportunities for the offense to gash them. And I think that's kind of how they view those two players, one against the other.
Yeah, so I think we've kind of answered the question where we're not concerned, and that's the defensive line. You know, they're just playing really well. Hutchinson is playing at a defensive player of the year level in a game where he did not show up in the stat sheet. He still had, depending on the source you look at, 10 to 15 pressures, you know, career type night in terms of affecting the pocket. As mentioned, Levi's playing really well. I thought Aleem had his best game. We already know what he's capable of. DJ Reader, nobody wants to run up the middle against these guys for good reason. You know, and he had a couple pass rushes where one, he got the sack, one, he completely put the center on his ass. I mean, just bowled him over, and Geno, as Geno does, got the ball out quickly. The defensive line talent and depth is really good. I'd say if there's a weakness, and I hate saying this because I like the man a lot, but Kyle Pecos, you know, certainly struggled in the reps he's played. Makes me all the more curious to see what Broderick Martin can do. Look, second year, leverage issues, we know them, but there was enough in the preseason where he had these splashes, these moments of brilliance where he's just so big, so rangy. You know, if you're going to need a guy for a series or two a half, I think Martin has clearly a higher ceiling than Pecco offers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you start dipping into the back seven, and it's it's just real hit or miss right now. And I think it was perfectly summed up with 7 pass breakups and 7 penalties against Seattle, right? Like they're ultra physical. I thought it was really interesting, the game plan, after all this talk of being more man focused. They played a ton of zone against Seattle. Not sure why that was Aaron Glenn's decision. I'm sure that there was something on tape with what he saw with the way the receivers worked. Maybe it was protecting against the deep ball, but you know, certainly led to a lot of ups and downs from that group. But I still think that there's more positive than negative. I think they're still tracking upwards. You know, you get Branch out there and you let Kirby get away from the line of scrimmage where he, you know, tends to make a few more mistakes with his risk taking. Like it's just a solid group. And, you know, even the defense, it just doesn't have nearly as many holes as the past, and just not many holes at all, really, overall.
Yeah. I don't think we can emphasize Hutchinson's development enough. And I think sometimes we forget that even second overall picks have tons of room to grow when they come to the NFL, and his growth this season is so evident. And I think one sack best highlights it, and it was the sack he had against the Cardinals at the end of the game. And if you think about Hutch as a rookie pass rusher, it was the spin move that we all knew he had in college and some speed to power, but he has so much more at his disposal now, and he is so much sharper at setting offensive tackles and offensive linemen up over the course of the game. And that last sack he had in the Cardinals game, he had been chopping and chopping and chopping, using the chop move all game long. He really hadn't spun at all. And he hits Paris Johnson late in that game when the defense needed one more play to basically seal it. And he comes with a chop and then he spins inside. And he combined it into this chop spin move that he had never really had or shown through 2 seasons. And he throws Johnson totally off balance. He gets home to Murray and he forces the Cardinals into a field goal, and the game is essentially over. And he just has more in his bag. And Terrell Williams, new D-line coach, has taught him, as Aaron Glenn told us, that the usefulness in also spinning inside, not just outside. And
that's become his go-to move this year.
And so we're seeing a much more three-dimensional pass rusher. I mean, he's got the dip and rip, the chop spin now. He still has the speed to power, and he just has so many different ways of breaking down offensive tackles and setting them up over the course of the game. And we are looking at a legitimate defensive player of the year candidate. I think they have to be thrilled with where Aiden Hutchinson is 4 games into his 3rd season.
Yeah, and you know what I like is the way that defensive line is really complementing his skill set. It feels like it's built around him, right? That's why you brought Davenport in. That's why you've asked Pascal to lean into this physicality, this bull rushing style, because all that does is it eliminates the quarterback's ability to bail opposite Hutchinson, right? And so you've got Levi and Pascal on the outside doing that, or you've got Levi and Aleem doing it on the inside, or certainly Reader eating up any kind of escape lane up the gut. And you're seeing as he's coming out of these spin moves, or he's been rushing. That's the other thing with Aiden. He's been rushing really, really wide. You know, Jim Schwartz would be proud with his super wide 9 alignment, but it's given him this running start. He's got this kind of skip step that you've seen with Houston working really effectively, that he kind of uses to accelerate into a chop that allows him to kind of bend the edge pretty tightly. But if he gets there, often the quarterback has nowhere to go. And that's why these pressures last year that were just pressures are now translating into more sacks. And when they're not turning into sacks for Hutchinson, what you're seeing is what you saw last week in Seattle, where they try to step up and escape and they just get swallowed up by the Lions defensive tackles, because that's where finally allowed somebody else to get a sack, right? Reader gets one.
Yeah.
I think Aleem and Levi split the other, and it was in large part created because Hutchinson forced that. He forced that quarterback to step up into it. And so it's all working really well there. You know, I think they still have to. I asked Campbell about it, and the answer was kind of vague, but I still think they have to find a way to get quarterbacks to hold on to the ball for a quarter second longer, half a second longer, so that these more of these things can more of these sacks can happen, because I don't know if I've ever seen a quarterback just have the trigger that Geno had in that game. It was really impressive stuff. You know, physicality is going to get you some flags, but I don't know. I feel like Arnold and Davis are really, really close to being very tough to throw. And I think the flags are going to go down. I think the PBUs are going to go up. And as long as those two stay healthy, which is not a given, I think they've both been nicked up already a couple times this year, but you know, the future with that tandem is really, really bright.
Yeah. I think you have to feel pretty good about the way Terrion has looked in coverage. And what I mean by that is that he is, for the most part, in stride
with
the receivers. And you hear the coaches use that term all the time. And in some ways, maybe he has been too sticky. I mean, he could certainly afford to be less handsy. And obviously, he needs to get his head around more quickly in coverage. But those are technique issues that you can easily coach. The natural ability to run with top tier, God tier, as the kids say, athletes on the outside is innate, and he has it. And I think over the course of the season, they'll sort out the issues that have popped up when the ball is coming his way. But he has clear cover ability. And then Carlton Davis has played, I think, better than people maybe want to give him credit for. And I know that the passer rating against might not be pretty, and the receptions and yards allowed might not be pretty, but he has taken on some really hard matchups. And like, you go to last Monday, or I guess it was this Monday, he traveled with DK Metcalf for pretty much that entire game. And DK had 12 targets, and he only caught 7 passes, and that's some pretty good work by Carlton Davis. Now, yes, there were a number of flags thrown in there that don't show up in those numbers, but I think the Lions have received so far from Carlton Davis what they were hoping for, and it's a fearless, physical, and sound tackling cornerback in the run game. And I agree, as Terrion develops and Carlton and Terrion grow more used to operating as a tandem, that secondary will only improve. And Kirby Joseph is playing the best ball of his career, and that should not be overlooked either.
Well, that's gonna perfectly lead us into our next segment. We're gonna go and answer some of the kids' questions from the Detroit Football Network chat, and we will do that after we hit a little break. All right, Will, we're back from break, and you know, this is something we talked about last week of maybe turning into a side episode, and so let's just call this a trial run or experiment. We didn't have a great plan of attack today, but we can make this work. Clearly, we're at 35, 40 minutes on this thing already, but you know, I went into the chat over on the site at the Detroit Football Network and, you know, asked the kids if they had anything on their brain. So without writing any of their questions down, I'm just going to scroll through there. And, you know, I had seen the first question, and you'd brought up Kirby Joseph playing at a really high level. And so the first question was from Trevor, and he was asking if we think that the Kirby's at a Pro Bowl or All Pro level to start this season.
Well, he's at a Pro Bowl level, and
no doubt.
If you look at his numbers since he entered the NFL, well, I guess since his debut, I think is now first or second among safeties in passes defended, and he's right there in terms of interceptions too. And I love what he said in response to your question after the game Monday night, when you asked him, at what point did you know that you were going to intercept that pass from Geno Smith? And Kirby said, as only Kirby can, when he threw it. And he's playing with such swagger, and he's not short on it at all. I mean, CJ Gardner-Johnson last year told me he equates Kirby Joseph to Frozone from The Incredibles, because he's just icy as all get out. It helps that he's playing next to Brian Branch, and I don't say that facetiously as a big Brian Branch champion, but I asked Kirby about that last week. You know, what has playing alongside Branch allowed you to do? He said, well, first of all, he and I are always on the same wavelength, and we kind of have this telepathy that allows us to chase balls and to hawk routes without really even having to communicate it. He said it's also allowing him to play more physically and to come down and tackle whenever he sees an opportunity. And for all the talk of Kirby Joseph ball production, he's a physical player. Like, he relishes that part of the game. So I think we're seeing all of his traits shine through the first four games of this season.
Yeah, I think Pro Bowl without question through the first quarter of the season. I'm not in tune enough with all the safeties of the league. I'm, you know, just strictly based on his production. I know he's second at his position in interceptions. I believe McKinney, who signed with Green Bay, has got four already. Don't know the context there, but look, Kirby's interceptions have been really critical in the moments they've happened. And that one Monday night was absurd. I mean, it was receiver grade hands. Let's just go with that. Just the timing of the jump, the ability to come down and secure that ball was just so impressive. And you mentioned the physicality. There's a couple times on tape in this game where I feel like they had Brandon Joseph playing deep because that was a little less intricate of responsibilities for a guy that kind of got thrust in there in his first start. And so normally that would be Kirby's spot. I know they flip and switch, but you know, Kirby was a little bit more in the box this game. And there are a few plays that he made against the run where it was just like, damn, like, it's not his strength. It's never been his strength, but there was one where he shed a block, and it was a receiver or a tight end, but he shed a block and made a stop at the line. And it's just like, wow. Like, he's just doing all the things right now. And, you know, you did feel Branch's absence there a couple times. There was a couple times where he was down low and he had, you know, responsibility within coverage of trips, right? And you got to have a lot of communication there with your cornerbacks. And a couple times that communication got fuzzy and led to some breakdowns. You know, it wasn't a perfect game for Kirby Joseph, but in terms of the entire body of work, and particularly when he's able to be put in the positions where he fits best, I mean, it's just been a really, really good season. He's made as much growth as anybody on this defense, including Aiden Hutchinson.
Yeah, so to confirm the stat that I was referencing, among NFL safeties since he entered the league in 2022, he is now first in passes defended and tied for first in interceptions. And this year, he's second in interceptions and tied for second in passes defended. So that should answer the question that was posed. Is he playing at a Pro Bowl level? Absolutely. And man, if it continues, he's probably pushing all pro level production.
All right, we're going to go to a question from Andrew. He wants to know what we think are the keys to going 3-1 after the bye. And I don't know if you've got the schedule in front of you, Will. I will pull it up. It's not easy. Three of those four games are on the road.
Yeah.
They've got Dallas and Minnesota right out the gate. Come home, play Tennessee, and then right back on the road to Lambeau to play the Packers.
Well, the first key would be exercising some demons in Dallas. And, you know, when Campbell was talking in the offseason about having certain teams circled on their schedule, you know, for as much as we have a bullseye on our back now, you know, we've got our targets too. Dallas was circled twice and three times and a fourth and a fifth. They are hungry to get to this game. And it's not an easy task to go down there, as Lions fans are well aware. But I think to go 3-1 in the next quarter begins with getting to Dallas and coming home 1-0. I think that would set them up really well over the next three. To put some of that baggage behind them and move on into the first real divisional gauntlet of the season.
Do you think they're petty enough to throw a pass to an offensive lineman in this game?
Several passes to offensive linemen.
just first play of the game.
Every single drive.
I mean, I almost expect 70 reporting to as eligible for the first play of the game.
Oh my God, it would be incredible.
And I'm sure, just based on the Tigers fans in that Houston series, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of you in Dallas. And
yep.
Look, you've had plenty of opportunities to go to Dallas, and I think the next two or three will be here. So get it in there while you can. I'm obviously very interested in the Minnesota game. They might be the biggest surprise in football, right? And
yeah,
given the Lions played on Monday night, you know, had the opportunity to sit down and watch some football on Sunday, and that Vikings team is very legit. I mean, just impressive on both sides of the ball. I think we knew what they could do defensively with some of their blitzing, but forgive me for doubting Sam Darnold, because yep, he has been phenomenal. I should have known better, because Kevin O'Connell is a really, really good coach that gets the most out of his players. And you give him that array of weapons. You know, it's been really fun. I've loved these quarterback redemption arcs. The Lions are facing all of them, apparently, with Baker, Geno, and now Sam Darnold. So I don't know, put another one on the list.
Yeah. I want to go back and maybe add some detail to my answer, because I basically said to go 3-1, they have to win some games.
Yeah,
exactly. It speaks for itself. But so here's what needs to happen in my eyes for the Lions to go 3-1 in their next four. And we've already touched on two of these things, but they need to figure out who is going to most suitably play, not the role, or maybe it's a collective to replace Derek Barnes on the defense, because his absence loomed large against the Seahawks. So what does that look like over the next four games? And then how soon is Frank Ragnow back? And maybe it is week six in Dallas. If it isn't, can they hold up another week, another 2 weeks, with Glasgow playing at center and Yody playing at guard? If those two things happen smoothly enough, A, they get Ragnow back, or they play okay without him, and B, they are able to compensate for Barnes's absence, I think they'll be okay in the next quarter.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the point, you know, the question I said I asked Campbell this week. It's how do you find a way for the coverage to hold up just that touch longer? Because I think the pass rush has been really, really good. He just hasn't had the opportunity to get home enough. And so certainly against Minnesota, you're going to have to find a way to hold up against that really talented, all those weapons that Minnesota has. And, you know, rumblings are that TJ Hockenson might be back for that game. I'm sure that will not be a storyline at all, given that Kirby Joseph ended his season last year. But, you know, that's a very talented offense in the same way that Seattle was. And so you've got to find a way to put a body on all those different weapons. I think maybe the difference is you can afford to play a little bit more man in that game, just because Darnold is not the same threat to escape the pocket and run.
Yeah, I hear that.
All right, dipping back to some questions here. I lost two assets.
Tigers win the World Series.
Oh, man. I don't see how not. So Anthony wants to know, with the players that have contract extensions potentially due this offseason, who has stock up and stock down? And it might help, I think, if I tell you some of those players, if you don't have, you know, off the top of your head. But,
yeah,
you know, some guys we've got: Carlton Davis, Marcus Davenport, Levi, Aleem, Iffy.
Yep.
Derek Barnes. You know, there's quite a few names. Yeah,
there's a core, no doubt.
So, look, I think Aleem is still top of the priority list. I understand that he has not had maybe the Hutchinson-level jump that I anticipated this year, but I still think he's a really, really good player, still fits exactly what they do, and I don't know if it's stock level, if you will, but
sure.
You know, I think he's still tracking toward a contract that's going to pay him in the ballpark of $20 million a season. And I do believe the Lions will get that done.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. He is clearly a part of this core, and that really has been the case for, I feel like, 2 years now. He came on strong at the end of his rookie season, took another jump last year, he is, to me, as central to their future and their present and just their overall identity as a player like Hutchinson. And yeah, I think Aleem gets his money. And look, it's a good time to be a D tackle looking for an extension because those salaries just keep on climbing. I mean, a number of guys signed this past offseason for north of 20, and that's probably near where Aleem comes in. Levi clearly stock up. I mean, this was a guy who had to announce himself this season, and he sure has so far. Looking at this list, look, if Fatima Lafonwu is such a it's a frustrating season for him so far because he closed last season so well, and he had developed this role as this blitzing safety, and he seemed poised to pick up where he left off entering this year. And it's just the injuries, and the injuries are the story of his career so far. I mean, he's battled them from essentially the moment he got here, and now he's on IR, and he won't play his first game this season until at least what, the middle of late October. And at that point, how do you even find a way to scheme him onto the field? Like, you're not taking Branch or Kirby off the field at this point, and I don't know how you put Iffy on the field. So stock down in his regard. You want to hit a couple more, Justin?
No, I don't know how you pay Melifonwu at this point, and I feel bad for the guy. I think a lot of these good injuries dude. Are out of his control. I know he has hit the TB12 regimen really, really hard to – you know, try to find solutions to some of his durability issues. And, you know, look, some guys just can't get over it. And it's not their fault. It's not for a lack of trying, but I'm with you. I don't know where he fits on the field. I speculated last week that, you know, maybe it's a nickel rotation at some level where you sub him out for a Meek and find some packages in that way. But your two safeties are playing at such a high level that I wouldn't mess with it.
Yeah. Derek Barnes, you know, Derek Barnes was putting himself in position for a payday. And again, we're going to have to see how long this absence lingers. But he is another guy that they have always viewed as a core piece of this defense, even if he questioned that himself at times. I think the biggest question for Barnes is simply how long is he out? If he can get back on the field, in the next month and a half and pick up where he was, then he's in position to be a $10 million plus linebacker on his next deal. And some of that will depend on, you know, maybe some more sack production, but he's definitely, you know, a strong end of the season push away from landing himself a nice deal here. And they'll probably have to have a conversation about whether that can be here financially. I mean, you cannot pay everyone. I think they would love to keep him. But I wonder if their belief in their linebacking depth would allow them to pass on extending Barnes as much as they might not want to. I don't know. What's your read there?
Yeah. I think Monday kind of pointed out just how valuable he is with just how many different mixing and matching pieces they're trying to find for a solution. And, you know, maybe over the duration he's out, which, you know, somebody tipped me off that he's dealing with an MCL injury. However many weeks that takes, there's grades, there's three different grades of sprains or tears. And I don't know the level, but it didn't sound like it was a complete one just based on Campbell's comments. But I was doing some early kind of comps trying to figure that out. I think right now he's kind of sitting in that $5 to $6 million a year range, even with the injury. I don't think this really affects his value, but I think you've nailed it perfectly. Like, without pass rush production, with how frequently he's rushing the passer, it's going to be tough to justify paying him more than that rate right there. But Let's say he comes back and he does get three or four sacks, and you see this development of move sets. I don't know if there's enough time for him to push himself into that $10 million a year range, but could he get in the 8 or 9? I mean, it's certainly possible. But yeah. We've talked about it. I mean, this team absolutely adores Derek Barnes. Yeah. They love everything about him. I think what you've seen with Brad Holmes and his relationship with the coaching staff and the communication there. Like, they find a way to get deals done with players they love, and certainly players Holmes is drafting.
Yeah.
So I do think they'll probably find a way to get something done with Barnes and keep him here long-term as well, which, you know, who could have possibly guessed when they drafted Jack Campbell that that would even be a conversation, mm-hmm. but it realistically is. I want to know if Levi continues to play at this level for 17 games, and I'm telling you, it is a really high level. Like, he is doing some really, really good things consistently. He complained about his run defense performance in week one. I think that's really made some strides in the weeks following. His pass rush continues to be effectively good. Like, what is this guy's market value given the injury history? I think it's a really, really tough conversation. And you talk about not being able to pay everybody, but I don't know, man. Like, the versatility, the attitude, the production, like, I could see them finding a way to pay him if the salary doesn't get outlandish. And I don't know, what is that salary to you?
Yeah, it's funny. I was about to put that to you. What would be an outlandish amount of money to pay Levi Onwuzurike? I think at his current rate, if he goes to market, is he a $18 million a year player? You know, and I know it's crazy to say given how little
Kevin Zeitler was on it
entering the season, but man, if he finishes this year with close to double digit sacks and a significant snap load and consistently strong play across from Hutchinson, he's going to put himself close to that range, and then the Lions would have to make a decision. It's interesting. Maybe his stock has risen so much that he would risk pricing himself out of a next deal with Detroit. But to your point, he's another Brad Holmes guy, and they have defended that pick through and through, even when he was unable to play, even when he wasn't producing, when he was playing. They always believed that that pick would come to fruition and prove fruitful. And now that it has, I think they're very keen on keeping him unless some team comes along and simply offers him a number that they can't match. Carlton Davis was another name you brought up.
It's the last one I was going to bring up for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. When they first acquired him in the offseason, there were very vague and unserious, I guess, extension talks. Both sides acknowledged that they would be interested in discussing it. I think Carlton was maybe more interested at the time than the Lions were. I'm not speaking with any sort of inside knowledge here other than just what I have observed. I think they just want to know, what does he look like over 17 games? Can we trust this guy to take the field for the bulk of the season? Because that was one big issue for him in Tampa. And then also, what do Terrion and Ennis look like over their first seasons? And I think that Carlton is stock up in their eyes so far because of the way those two things have sort of combined. Look, we haven't really seen anything from Ennis so far, who has been limited by injuries, and Terrion, not yet does he look like a true number one corner, and Carlton has held up just fine in coverage, and I think right now they would be, like, if the season ended today and they had to make a decision on Carlton Davis, I think they would be more likely than not to bring him back. Is that a fair way to put it?
I don't know if I feel as strongly as you do, to be honest.
Okay.
You know, just it goes back to the point of, like, you can't pay everybody. And so I was looking right now, Carlton Davis is already kind of in that upper echelon of average per year. He's just shy of $15 million, but the gap between him and that elite tier is pretty significant. So he's at $15 million average. The next tier up is 19, and there's a pretty good group at 19 million. It includes Jalen Johnson, who just resigned with the Bears. Mm-hmm. It includes Legarius Sneed, who was traded and re-signed with the Titans. Marshawn Lattimore, Trayvon Diggs. And so you're talking about a really, really good crop of corners. And I think Davis is a tier below them, but probably gets in that range just based on the inflation of the cap being, you know, guy that signs last. So you're looking at a contract that's somewhere in that $18 to $20 million range per year. And I don't know where the cutoff point is yet. Like, I haven't really sat down and thought. I know the Lions have a lot of cap space right now. I know they're going to roll over a lot next year. But you got Hutchinson coming up. You got Kirby Joseph coming up. You got Brian Branch coming up. Laporta and Gibbs at some point. So you have all these guys. This is what happens when you get good. You have all these guys you want to retain. And, you know, I think a lot of it will depend on how they feel about Ennis, you know, really coming into the end of the season. How is his development going? A lot of the things going to happen behind the scenes. Maybe we'll, I don't want to say get fortunate, because you don't want to see Davis or Arnold get hurt, but you know, there would be a silver lining in one of those situations if one of those guys has to miss a game or two or three to get an on-field evaluation to know where he's at, what his ability is to hold his own, to make a better judgment on what Davis brings to the table. And so, you know, it's just going to be a really tricky conversation. I think the Lions are going to be in a position where they're going to have to let a lot of guys hit the market and come back to them with whatever offer they get and say, hey, can you match? And, you know, there's going to be some tough decisions. They're going to have to let some guys go. And I think they'll choose Aleem, and I think they'll choose Derek Barnes over a Carlton Davis just because of the loyalty of the draft and develop. But I mean, certainly Davis has made a really strong impression. I think the way his coaches, both Townsend and AG, talked about him this week just show kind of this instant respect he's got in the building about the way he goes about his business. So, you know, as it is right now, it's a coin flip. Let's close with one more question. And here we go. From Brandon. He wants to know if the Lions have finally solved their third quarter scoring woes. And so while we were talking here, I looked it up, and guess who's number one in the NFL in third quarter scoring this year, Will?
The Detroit Lions.
Tied with the Buffalo Bills with 7.8 points per third quarter. And they did that without scoring a damn third quarter point against Arizona. So, look, I thought it was kind of a silly discussion last year. I understood that it kept showing it up, and but it's just such a weird fluid stat to kind of pin down. But look, I think they've looked a lot better coming out of the half this year, with sustained drives, with whatever you want to call it, adjustments. I think we've got to move on to the newest thing that's bugging us, because that ain't it anymore.
Yeah, they were, as an offensive collective, very disappointed in the way they came out of the half in week three against Arizona. And there was a clear emphasis on playing, to use the cliche, a full 60 minutes, a full four quarters. And they did that for the first time this season. I thought that they looked more detail oriented throughout that game. And they hit on a number of explosive plays. I think they had seven plays of 20 plus yards. I mean, that's proven way to put up big time points. And a few of those anyways came in the third quarter. So yeah, I think we can safely put that concern to bed.
I don't think it is tracked anywhere anymore, but there used to be a stat that I was enamored with because I thought it was really a defining of football success, called toxic differential. Are you familiar with this one?
No.
Yeah. So basically was explosive play margin and turnover margin kind of married. And I think, you know, those are two stats that you could look at consistently every week. Did you win the turnover battle? Did you win the explosive play battle? And explosive plays are talked about more and more in modern NFL. And I think certainly this year, because teams are making such a concerted effort to take them away. So, you know, I thought the Lions, you know, they certainly won the explosive play battle or held their own in it. And, you know, they forced the game's only turnover. And that, you know, again, it ultimately often leads to success.
They won the turnover battle, and they won the third quarter battle by 1 point. And as everyone knows, you win those two battles, you're going to win every single game.
I don't know about you. I think I kind of like this segment. We've been bandying about the idea of
when we're down in Allen Park, we can take these questions and if it makes sense, bring them to the players themselves. So we can definitely expand this element of the podcast.
Yeah, we could do man on the street style interviews.
I like that.
Just get the latest thoughts. I got a visitor here that's just super into the podcast, just keeps inching closer the entire time, and now is just under my chin. All right, I think that'll do us. As always, huge shout out, huge thanks to our producer, Zach Clark, who keeps putting up with our moving target schedules, hanging with us till I think Stoney and I recorded between 2 and 3:30 or 2:30 and 3:30 on Monday. And
Zach really wanted to record this one at 4:30 in the morning, but
we said no.
And said, no, Zach, unacceptable.
He's been awesome. And so we really appreciate Zach. He's going to produce this tonight. You will be able to listen to this on the free Odyssey app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. As always, you know, please subscribe, like, I'm blown away, Will. I don't know about you. All 5 stars on Spotify.
How about that? Apple.
Incredible.
Yeah, my mom has listened to my instructions.
She's got all 62 accounts logged in, and appreciate her jumping in. And then obviously, you know, Will and I do this whole reporting thing on the side when we're not podcasting. So you can find Will's work on 971theticket.com. You can find me at DetroitFootball.net, the Detroit Football Network's homepage. For Will Birchfield, I'm Justin Rogers. Thanks for listening, guys.